Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics Podcast, where we explore politics, economics, history, culture, everything to do here in the Midwest Heartland. This show is distributed by WVIK, the flagship national public radio station in the Quad City region of eastern Iowa and northwestern Illinois. And I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and today we're talking about what else? The election coming up in about a week here. And my focus is going to be on a topic central to our region here in the Midwest and in eastern Iowa and northwestern Illinois. The book is titled Trump Democrats and Trump's Democrats, I'm sorry. And my guest today is one of the co-authors, John Shields. The other author is Stephanie Moravchik. She is a historian and associate fellow at the Institute for Advanced Studies and Culture at the University of Virginia. And John, my guest, is associate professor of government at Claremont McKenna College. He's authored some other books here, but I want to get right into this. John, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Fascinating book. And as we'll get into here, there's a special reason of a focus on our region here that made this book appealing to me and made me reach out and talk to you because of the local angle. But I'm curious, obviously, this is a topic of great importance for this election coming up. But what drew you, I guess, to write this book? It's interesting to me that you're on the West Coast and Stephanie's the East Coast. How did this all come about, and how did you pick some of the places that you to focus your study on?
Well, you know, this book, like lots of books, was born on election night in 2016. You know, like lots of Americans, I was up late that night, as was Stephanie. We were, you know, on our laptops watching the election returns roll in, you know, it was one of the most surprising and astonishing political outcomes in my lifetime, and that sense of astonishment really deepened in the days and weeks that followed the election, because then we discovered that there were many places that had voted for Obama and flipped for Trump. And many of these places, Robin, you know, many of them were not just, many have not just supported Obama. They had supported Democrats, Democratic presidential candidates for a very long time. Some, in fact, had been so loyal to the Democratic Party that they had never voted for a Republican since prior to the New Deal. Some, you know, had flipped for Republicans, for, you know, Nixon in 72 or Reagan in 1984. And of course, you know, we're accustomed to talking about the Nixon Democrats and the Reagan Democrats. But the Trump Democrats are much more interesting. You know, Nixon won in a landslide in 72 and Reagan did as well in 1984. So it's not so surprising in many ways that there were lots of, you know, otherwise loyal Democratic communities and places that flipped. But 2016 wasn't a landslide, right? I mean, you know, Trump, in fact, lost. You know, he lost the popular vote. And yet he managed to win some of the most loyal blue communities in the country. And so that to us was fascinating and of great interest. And so we were itching to really get out of our bubbles and out into the country and try to make sense of what had happened.
And you did. And one of the places you came is not too far from here.
Yeah, that's right. You know, we, Ottumwa, Iowa, if you don't, if your listeners don't know it, you know, it's a fascinating place. It's a place with a large meatpacking plant. There's a John Deere factory. It has a long tradition of militant unionism that goes back really to the 1920s. It's a place like lots of other communities that voted for Trump that have fallen on hard times. You know, it was a relatively prosperous and thriving town back in the 60s, and that was largely because the corporate headquarters of the meatpacking plant used to be located in Ottumwa, and then due to globalization, you know, it left, and now it's owned by, I think, a Brazilian company. So yeah, we spent 3 summers in Ottumwa and learned a lot there.
So this sounds familiar to me because I live in a town in Illinois, outside of a town in Illinois with a meatpacking plant. So a lot of these issues were very, very familiar to me. Mm. But, I mean, Ottumwa was just voted Democratic every election. I mean, what was it going back? I don't recall, but it's very similar to the river counties here along the Mississippi River, not Scott County, but down in Des Moines County, in Burlington, and Fort Madison, and Lee County, where they had voted Democratic for years and switched to Trump. In fact, these Obama-Trump counties that voted for Obama twice and Trump. Most were in the Midwest region, and then Iowa had the most of any state in the nation. So that's why this topic is so important. In northwestern Illinois, most of the Obama-Trump counties in Illinois are right up here. So it's interesting to look at this, both for what happened in 16 and what may happen next week. I circled this, and this has got to be one of my first questions. But you say that Donald Trump, let me find it here, is the first working class, America's first working class president. This guy is a billionaire. How explain that.
Yeah. Well, he's working class partly because he respects what social scientists call an honor culture. So I'll sort of lay that out a little bit. Honor cultures are common throughout most of the world, actually, but they're also common in most working class places in the United States. And what they all share is a sense that one must never ignore a slight or insult, right? So one must, if you're in an honor culture, one must always defend your reputation for toughness by always responding to insults. And that means that if you don't punch back, it's always read as weakness, right? It's never read as taking the high ground. And so one of the things that struck us about Ottumwa and a lot of the other places that we lived is this culture is really powerful there. We call it at different times a kind of there was a kind of Trumpian political culture. And we saw this in Ottumwa, and I'll give a couple of examples. In 2016, the Democratic Party in Ottumwa was really divided between supporters of Sanders and those who supported Clinton. And there was a fight that nearly broke out at the Democratic county meeting over which candidate should be endorsed. And one of the would-be combatants is Jerry Parker, who is the current county supervisor and former mayor. And Sanders said, Parker said, Parker, I should say, is now in his 70s. And he said, 40 years ago, I would have punched this guy out, but I'm older, so it didn't quite come to blows. And another politico there said, described the culture this way. He said, solving problems with violence is sort of ingrained in the nature of Ottumwa. There's no ignoring an insult. And we saw this culture in everyday life, too, not just in politics. Maybe I'll give one more example to give the listeners a little flavor for this. But we talked to one Trump supporter who had worked for years in a corn processing plant, actually just outside of Ottumwa. And one of the dynamics there is that, the plant was full of these working class technicians who loved to torment the new college-educated engineers who would come into the plant. And, they were just out of college, and the working class engineers would have to show them the ropes, right? They'd show them how the plant worked. And they loved harassing these college kids. And so they'd really, they'd give them a sort of hazing, They'd say things like, you're a dumb effer, right? And then they'd say things like, say it, right? You're a dumb effer. And this Trump supporter I talked to is sort of watching all of this. And she's looking at this young college kid and she's thinking to herself, she says, look, stand up for yourself, right? Don't let him do this to you. Put this guy in his place. But he didn't, right? And in fact, the young man had to quit, and he kind of had to in this world because his reputation or honor could not be salvaged. So I think that one of the things is that, critics of Trump supporters sometimes read this desire for strongmen as a kind of is rooted in a sort of authoritarian personality, right? They see all this behavior as some kind of proto-fascism or a kind of, or is rooted in, again, in a kind of personality disorder. But that really misses the cultural context in which desires for strong men are desired, So I think that one of the things is that Trump sort of spoke and behaved in ways that were really familiar in places like Ottumwa, right? Trump never lets anything slide off his back. And in leafy college towns like mine, you know, my neighbors and colleagues see Trump and they see someone who's kind of a brute, right? Someone who's declassé, someone who really doesn't fit into the professional class. But in places like Ottumwa, you know, that's very familiar. In fact, that's how one should respond, right? One should never let anything roll off your back. You always have to defend your reputation for toughness. Otherwise, people are going to exploit you and take advantage of you. So Trump is, yes, he's very wealthy, but he behaves in ways that are culturally familiar in working class communities, and that gives voters there, I think, a sense of cultural proximity, right? He feels like one of them. He talks like one of them. He behaves like one of them. And I think that gives them a sense that he can be trusted.
You make the point, and I circled it here in the book, that Trump violated the norms of national politics, but not local politics in areas in working class Democratic areas like Ottumwa.
Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, John.
No, that's exactly right. Right. We sometimes I think those local norms don't always import well into the national orbit. So I'm happy to talk about that. But yes, that's right. We sometimes imagine that our national norms hold at the local level. But in fact, local norms look quite differently, and I think they function better locally. You know, I think these Trumpian political norms work better at the local level than at the national level.
Your book directly takes on some other books that have written about this phenomenon of the Obama-Trump voters in the working class. And both of them, two examples I'll give here, were both guests of mine. In fact, I just had Tim Carney on a couple weeks ago. Mm-hmm. But he talked about the alienation in these communities, and you kind of differentiated on that and expanded on that a little bit, and maybe didn't find what the alienation that he was talking about.
Yeah, and I think I like Carney's book, and I think he's onto something in a lot of ways. But I think what it misses is the deep sense of loyalty to place in a lot of these communities. You know, one of the things that really struck us is that citizens in Ottumwa and also the other communities we visited feel deeply connected to the places they live in. Their social and political identities, in fact, are really deeply and almost inextricably tied to the places they live. And that makes Americans from even nearby towns and counties are sort of outsiders to some degree. And because their identities are really deeply rooted in the places that they live, you know, we say that their political ideology or ethos is almost like Ottumwa first, right? But before Trump coined the idea of America first, Ottumwans really had a sense of primacy of place that their primary political allegiances are really to their town. And we saw this in everyday life, right? So a lot of local Ottumwans really try to buy locally, right? They want to buy in the city itself, even if it costs them a little extra money to do so, because they feel like it's really an investment in their community, and they have a sort of obligation and loyalty to their community. This behavior sometimes baffled The occasional libertarian we bumped into in Ottumwa, right, who finds this sort of behavior pretty strange. We talked to one guy who runs a local auto parts store in Ottumwa, and he said, and I'm quoting him here, he said, you know, I've seen people go to a local dealership in this town and spend, you know, thousands of extra dollars more on a vehicle they could get in Des Moines. Right? But Ottumwans do that because, again, they have a deep sense of loyalty to place. We saw this in some of the other communities. We visited two, and we went to Elliott County, which is a small rural county in Appalachia. And there was a big scandal that developed because a superintendent job was offered to someone from a neighboring county. And that was a scandal because locals felt that county jobs should benefit one's neighbors. So this is all important and relevant, partly because it helps us make sense of a puzzling finding that, or set of findings that emerged after 2016. After 2016, there was a number of studies that looked at individual voters and found that, you know, individual voters who supported Trump weren't necessarily more likely than Clinton supporters to be unemployed or to be worried about their personal finances. On the other hand, there was also another set of research that looked at places, and it found that places that swung for Trump did have all kinds of economic and social problems. And a lot of the social scientists who looked at this research and tried to square it basically dismissed the places that looked at places, right? They said, look, counties don't vote, towns don't vote, people do. And so it doesn't really matter they weren't so interested in the fact that there were all these places that were really had fallen on hard times and voted for Trump. And they were very dismissive of it. But that argument really assumes that people are really just voting their economic interest and aren't connected to places, right? Don't care about the welfare of their communities. So one of the arguments we make is that Trump voters were, on the one hand, not necessarily more economically distressed than Clinton voters, but they were more likely to live in places that were precisely because they care about places, right? They really care about their communities. And so precisely because they're not alienated from these places and care about their welfare, they supported Trump.
Yeah, that the idea of a town consciousness kind of goes against the Kathy Kramer theory of a rural consciousness or a white consciousness that's posited by others. I think you
that's
just
right.
touched on my next question, which I don't think you addressed directly in the book, but I think I know the answer based on what you just said. But Thomas Franks long had this theory since he wrote the book, What's the Matter with Kansas, that working class folks don't vote their own interests. And it's based purely on economic issues. I assume, based on what you're saying, you would take issue with that.
Yeah, no, I think Frank is wrong. I mean, I do think that, and I think that Frank, I mean, it'd be interesting to see what he would. I guess I haven't followed him the last couple of years, Robin. So I'd be curious to know what he would say about Trump voters in these places. But no, I think it's a really good question. And no, that's right. I think they care, but it's not necessarily their personal finances. You know, it's they care about the communities that they live in, which are really facing serious threats. I mean, long before Trump coined the phrase, make America great again, Ottumwans were trying to make Ottumwa great again. Right. And that's true throughout Iowa. Right. There's all these small towns that are trying to revitalize their main streets and very much trying to bring back their former selves. So I think Trump's sort of restorationist rhetoric really resonated in places that have really been trying to restore themselves for a long time.
Well, I think you made some other really good points in this book, too, and it leads to the question I have, whether Democrats have truly learned the lesson of 2016. It seems to me like some of the leadership, the national committees and all, still don't want to accept the reasons that Trump won, which I think you've laid out pretty well here, and that a lot of things happened, bad things happened in rural working class areas that the party really didn't address or acknowledge, and Trump spoke to. And you talk here about an empathy gap, which I thought was really interesting, that the progressives are more in tune to race than they are class, and that they're more sympathetic to issues faced by working class African Americans and Hispanics than they are working class whites.
I think that's right, and I think a lot of the social science that emerged after 2016 reinforced those assumptions, those bad assumptions. You know, I think that however much race mattered in 2016, there was a tendency in a lot of the research to reduce Trump's support to racism. And I think one of the things we try to do in this book is to say, look, that these folks are much more three-dimensional, right? And white identity isn't their only, or maybe even their most important social identity, right? If that were the case, if white identity was their only identity, the only thing they cared about, they wouldn't have supported Obama twice, right? It's sort of hard to make sense of why they would do that. So one of the things we try to do is sort of show them in a more three-dimensional way and highlight their other identities beyond their racial one, right? They also have strong class-based identities. They have strong place-based identities, as I've just suggested. And I don't know, I mean, the Democrats, I think one danger for them now is they might, you know, they might well win this election. It looks like they will at this stage. And if they do, they might just decide that they don't need these Obama-Trump counties, right? In fact, they might win without them, right? They might drive up turnout in the suburbs. They might increase minority turnout and then just decide that that they don't need these voters. And I think that would be a shame. I mean, I think it'd be a shame for Democrats in a way, right? I mean, there's lots of ways to win the next election, but I think they still have to ask themselves a more existential question, which is really what kind of party do they want to be? You know, what kind of party do the Democrats want to be? And in particular, do they want to be a broad-based party of the working class, right? Do they want to sort of cobble back together this New Deal coalition, which has been coming apart for decades? I think our book is really shows the ways in which it's still unraveling even today. And you know, I think they might decide that they don't want to try to reassemble it at all if they just think that all these white working class voters are just a bunch of deplorables, right? Who would want a bunch of deplorables and racists in your party? But I think if they do that, they're really taking another step away from reconstituting a party that really does represent the working class.
Well, and I think beyond that, they may be able to put together this cycle an electoral college majority without the white working class voters. But boy, to win some Senate races, U.S. Senate races, right, to win governor races, to win state legislative,
yes,
races,
yes,
is going to be a bigger challenge for them.
No, I think that's right, and you know, it's something that you know, even if you look at 2018, where Democrats did well, they didn't swing that many state legislatures. You know, the state legislatures are still dominated by the Republican Party, and the Republican Party is really quite strong at the local level. And I think a lot of the kinds of communities, the Democratic communities that swung for Trump, there's a danger, at least for Democrats, that they'll slowly become Republican. And so Democrats now risk becoming even less influential and powerful at the local level. And if, you know, if you're a Democrat, I think you have to think, like, you have to remind yourself that not everything is about national politics. You know, there's a lot of issues that Democrats care about, from criminal justice reform to education, that are really controlled at the local level. So not everything is the White House, right? Those aren't the only political stakes that matter. And I think Democrats need to remind themselves of that fact.
There's so much more in this book I'd love to talk about, but we're about out of time. I got to close at one question. Do you think Biden will is the type of candidate, I guess, or will he get back some of these Obama-Trump voters? And will it be enough to carry some of these key states in the Midwest that decided the election last time, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question, right? What's going to happen on Tuesday? It's a big one on my mind. We'll certainly be up late watching those returns come in. My guess is, and this is just a guess, you know, my guess is he does peel back some of those voters. But I guess I wouldn't be surprised if he loses them. I think one reason that's true is, you know, a lot of the voters we spoke to have been watching lots of Fox News since the election, and they've done so because they have a sense that Fox News is pro-Trump, right, or at least is an anti-Trump, and these voters are so they've been consuming a lot more conservative media since the election, and therefore they're becoming really politically socialized to think of the world as a conservative Republican would. And so I think they're really drifting. And you see this, too, in party registration, which is now increasing in these communities. But having said that, you know, look, I mean, it's been a bad year for the country. It's been a bad year for Trump in a lot of ways. And it wouldn't surprise me if the Democrats claw back at least some of these voters.
Okay. John Shields has been our guest today. He's the Associate Professor of Government at Claremont McKenna College and co-author of this book called Trump's Democrats, along with Stephanie Moravchik. It's a very, very timely book, and it's got a lot of good information in it. And if you're still wondering out there, how does somebody who votes for Barack Obama twice vote for Donald Trump? A lot of answers are right in here. And again, there's a local angle. Ottumwa is about 140 miles to our southwest here, so John came and, as he said, was on the ground talking to people, which I think is something that perhaps a lot of the press didn't do and missed this, what was going on here 4 years ago. But John's been our guest again, and John, thank you very much for your time, and we'll see what happens next Tuesday. It'll keep a lot of us up late and keep us busy afterwards.
Thank you, Robin.